to the second case of the day, the United States versus Khan. Ms. Lewis.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Good morning.
Would it please the court? My name is Brooke Lewis, and I represent the appellant Shaquille Wamick. My colleague, Michael Levinson, represents the appellant Mazhar Khan. We've each reserved 7 minutes for our arguments with 1 minute jointly for rebuttal. We request this court to reverse the judgment of the trial court for the reasons as set forth in our joint brief. Today, we will be talking about two particular, the constitutional arguments, and we will rely on our brief for the other arguments.
Before you do, though, would you be kind enough to tell me what happened to the other seven co-defendants? Were all of them purchasing from the same undercover agent?
Correct. That's my understanding. The other remaining defendants in the case, not really remaining, they all pled out and they all got probation for their purchases of unstamped cigarettes, which they were then going to sell as unstamped cigarettes, which distinguishes them from our clients in the instant case who were selling stamped cigarettes after purchasing them unstamped and buying stamps from the state of Illinois.
And there's one other question that's sort of been bothering me, and because your the briefs one of them, it is one, suggests that it's possible that one could be in complete compliance with the state licensing and taxation requirements and yet still be in violation of the federal law. And I've been trying to figure out a scenario where that might actually happen, and I haven't been I'm not smart enough to do it, so you have to help me.
Absolutely, Your Honor. I think that we're in a situation where the federal government can come in and apply its thoughts, its beliefs as to what a violation means under the federal law, due to the federal law being fairly vague about what it is that constitutes a violation. It just vaguely says that it's the accounting procedures pursuant to the state tax code. Now, the state tax code is fairly extensive, and there are significant procedures, there are investigators, and they have their own administrative remedies for any problems that might ensue, that include taking away a licensee's license, that include confiscating cigarettes, that include fines. But in this case, the federal government can come in and decide for the state whether there is a state violation. Even in this instant case, while Agent Huff testified on the stand that he believed that some of the accounting documents that were submitted were either incomplete or insufficient in some way, the state never acted on those items. The state does its investigation. The only investigation that had been done which resulted in any action happened prior to the events in the instant case. Agent Huff had found a number of cigarettes that had been partially stamped in convenience store, I believe, and had come back to Mr. Wamick and said, look, these are partially stamped. Mr. Wamick said, our machine is broken. Look, we're getting a new machine, and then restamped those cigarettes before putting them back into the stream of commerce. Does that answer your question, Your Honor?
I have to think about it.
So we believe that the statute should be reversed due to the underlying statute, which is 18 U.S.C. 2342A, which must be read in conjunction with 2341-2, which defines what a contraband cigarette is unconstitutional as applied to these specific defendants due to their status as licensees.
But have you located any other cases that challenge 2342A as an infringement on state police powers?
No, not in the situation as these defendants are in. The case law that both we have been able to find and based on the government's brief that the government has been able to find all relates to people who don't fit into one of the four categories. To convict under the statute, under the statutes as combined. The defendants must knowingly ship, transport, etc., more than 10,000 cigarettes, and they must be unstamped, and they must be in possession of anyone other than certain exceptions. None of these other defendants in the other case law go into any of those exceptions. When we're talking about, for example, U.S. versus Skozin, which was relied upon by the trial court in its decisions, Mr. Skozin wanted to claim that because he didn't fit under any of these, that the tax law no longer applied to him. That's obviously not the case, not what we're claiming here at all. Again, in Abdullah, which was, again, cited by the U.S. government, Mr. Abdullah was taking cigarettes that were from a low-tax state and bringing them into a high-tax state and selling them in that high-tax state, which is essentially selling unstamped cigarettes. However, in a position like the defendants are currently in, the defendants were licensed by the state, they applied, filled out a lot of paperwork, were under an enormous amount of regulation, and they would then purchase stamps from the state at enormous expense. My client alone spent over $2 million in cigarette stamp purchases. Would then purchase unstamped cigarettes and take those stamps, apply them to the packs of cigarettes, and then release them into the stream of commerce.
Let me get to the stream of commerce issue then. How can it be unconstitutionally vague if Congress is regulating something that is affecting interstate commerce here?
I think that those are sort of two different issues. I think that the unconstitutionally vague issue applies to the specific language as used in the federal statute. And the specific language that's used appears nowhere in the state law. The accounting and payment requirements.
It can regulate it federally without referring to, we have some statutes that refer to state laws, some that actually incorporate state laws. But here, if they're making the findings that we've got a condition that is impacting interstate commerce, we're going to regulate it in this way, why is that unconstitutional?
Well, and I think if you look at U.S. versus Lopez, which was cited by the government in its brief, that does go through the various categories of affecting interstate commerce.
And you think it fit out of the Lopez factors?
In the Lopez case, if you look at the facts of the Lopez case, that the government, the federal government, broadly had the right to regulate education. But when it came down to the specific law about whether a gun could be on the school premises or not, that the court held that the Congress has the power to regulate activities that substantially affect interstate commerce, but that authority does not extend to each and every aspect of that activity. In the instant case, we have the situation where the only difference between my client and a client and another licensee who isn't charged under the statute is that the federal government has decided through their own system that our clients have somehow violated some aspect of the state law. And I see that my time is up, and I don't want to intrude too much on Mr. Levinson's time. But if you have any further questions.
You've reserved a minute for rebuttal.
We have, yes.
All right.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Lewis. Mr. Levinson?
Thank you. May it please the Court. My name is Michael Levinson, and I represent Mazur Khan in this case. And I think a good way to look at this case and this appeal is it's the confluence of two clauses, the Commerce Clause and the Tenth Amendment. And it's the Commerce Clause road that is meeting the wall of the Tenth Amendment. And so you've got Commerce Clause power that travels down this road. And here it could certainly, this is commerce, cigarette trade, the transportation, hijacking of cigarettes, selling of stolen stuff. This could all be regulated under the Commerce Clause by the federal government. But now it runs into a situation where we now have a state-licensed agent, such as Mr. Khan, Mr. Womack, who have lawfully purchased these cigarettes. They don't have any stamps. They can stamp them, and they're regulated by the state of Illinois to apply these stamps, to fill out forms. And so now you've got a situation where the state of Illinois has now imposed a series of regulations and has its own department, the Department of Revenue, which is going to oversee this activity within the state of Illinois. These cigarettes are brought to Illinois to be stamped by Illinois stampers, and that is the 10th Amendment wall.
But isn't that argument disregarding, let me find the language, the requirement that the licensed distributor can only apply stamps to original packages of cigarettes purchased or obtained directly from an in-state manufacturer, maker, fabricator, and that Milwaukee warehouse established by the ATF would not qualify as an in-state maker, manufacturer, fabricator?
Right, so that is a state regulation that's found in one of the paragraphs in the state law regulating these distributed, these stampers. So when he bought them, so when Mr. Kahn purchased those cigarettes in Wisconsin, he did not break any law because it only says he cannot stamp them with Illinois stamps. It doesn't, so he brought them to Illinois expecting that he would get the paperwork showing that they were licensed. But let's suppose he never got that paperwork. He could then sell those. He could sell those to a distributor in Indiana, which is not regulated by Illinois law. He could sell those unstamped cigarettes to another state, another distributor, another. He could keep them for himself. He could destroy them. But the point is that there is nothing to prohibit them. Well, first, I guess the point is that it's all regulated by the state of Illinois.
But beyond the after the fact attempt to stamp some of the cigarettes that have been purchased from the undercover agent, was there any evidence presented that the cigarettes were ever actually stamped, or was the only evidence that the defendants could have complied with the stamping requirements because, of course, they were licensees?
Well, in this case, the evidence was that Mr. Kahn, in contravention of the statute, did stamp them. He stamped them and he sold them. So he paid an Illinois tax on something that he was not supposed to pay an Illinois tax, and then he sold them. And I guess my point is that, well, Illinois has a mechanism for dealing with that. And instead, what the federal government does by this small subsection of a subparagraph is now it's taken that power away from the state regulators who have experience in regulating this and a desire to regulate it and said, well, we're going to take that away. We're going to give this to a federal jury in Wisconsin.
But doesn't Congress do that in other areas of law? If they find that there is an impact on interstate commerce with their dual sovereignty, they can create the law and say that if it would be a violation of a particular state law, that is sufficient. I'm trying to think of one off the top of my head. The Sex Crimes Act, so if you travel interstate commerce to have sexual intercourse with someone, blah, 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 and it has to be a violation of a particular state law. So it could be different. Every single state could be different. What's the difference between that?
Well, in this case, the cigarette, it was not illegal to travel to Wisconsin to get these cigarettes. It wasn't illegal to bring them to Illinois. Once they're in Illinois, they're subject to, and actually all their activities are subject to an Illinois regulatory regime where, as a person going out and committing sex crimes, they're not subject to any regulatory regime. And I guess that's why I say that it is, the Commerce Clause is a continuum. And at some point, the government power to regulate pursuant to the Commerce Clause has to wane. And at some point, the state rights under the 10th Amendment have to assert themselves. And that power is... this is a good example of when that power would have...
Can you distinguish for me, then, what's the difference between just having a violation that would violate a state law versus a regulatory scheme?
Well...
What impact does that analysis have?
In this whole confluence of these two areas, you've got the state of Illinois is seeking to regulate activity within its state, and it has expressed a desire to do that and to set up regulations, whereas other violations of state law by other citizens or even, let's say, a retailer that is not subject to this heavy regulation, The state has not desired, has not expressed a desire to regulate them. And then maybe that is a good place for the Commerce Clause and the federal government to come in and impose a regulation.
Isn't your 10th Amendment challenge to 2342A being raised for the first time on appeal?
I think that the it's been given that name for the first time on appeal. I think in our Rule 29 motions and 34 motions, we try to articulate this. Without
mentioning 10th Amendment?
Without mentioning it, and I think that we've finally brought it together under the 10th Amendment, and unfortunately, there isn't a lot of case law with regard to this issue, and it's and with regard to people situated like Khan and Juan. I see my time has run up and run out, and I will have a seat.
Thank you, Ms. Levinson. Ms. Borges?
May it please the Court, Assistant United States Attorney Laura Kaczurski appearing on behalf of the United States of America. First, I'll pick up on Judge Rovner's question about the standard of review with respect to this 10th Amendment Commerce Clause issue. It was not raised below, and was therefore waived. It wasn't raised in Khan's motion for acquittal, which was brought pursuant to Rule 29, which is not an appropriate procedure to raise a constitutional issue. That brief nowhere mentions the 10th Amendment or the Commerce Clause. It simply argues that Mr. Khan was not guilty of the charged offenses. And neither did Mr. Womack's motion for judgment of acquittal, which was also brought under Rule 29, specifically make the constitutional argument. Now, if this court concludes that the mislabeling of the argument was a result of neglect or inadvertent accident, or then this court may, of course, apply the plain error standard of review, which is quite a difficult, high standard to meet. That being said, regardless of the standard of review, I think this argument is foreclosed, specifically as this court and the U.S. Supreme Court has made clear, where Congress has the authority to act under the Commerce Clause, the 10th Amendment is a complement to Article 1 of the Constitution. They're complements to each other, so when Congress acts pursuant to an enumerated power here under the Commerce Clause, there can't be a violation of the 10th Amendment. And the Sixth Circuit has made clear that upheld this particular statute, Section 2342, as a valid exercise of Congress's authority under the Commerce Clause to regulate activities that have a substantial relation to interstate commerce.
I want to ask you a focus question. Did the jury hear any evidence suggesting that the defendants did not intend to buy more stamps for the cigarettes that they purchased?
The evidence presented with respect to whether there was enough tax stamps purchased by these two defendants in order to stamp all of the cigarettes that they obtained was evidence comparing the number of tax stamps that they had purchased legitimately, and there's only one way to purchase tax stamps, and that's through the Illinois Department of Revenue, and taking that number and comparing it to the number of packs of cigarettes that each defendant bought either illegally from the ATF undercover warehouse, both from the ATF undercover warehouse in addition to those packs of cigarettes that were bought legitimately from licensed manufacturers. And so when those numbers were compared, there simply there were not enough tax stamps in order to apply a tax stamp to each pack.
But do cigarettes have, I know nothing about cigarettes. Do cigarettes have a long shelf life?
Well, my understanding is that they do not, but there was no evidence ever presented that these defendants, even to the extent they could argue that, oh, I had, you know, 200,000 packs of cigarettes sitting in my warehouse waiting to be stamped, there was no evidence that they ever purchased the tax stamps to sell them, nor was there any evidence that they were sitting in the warehouse.
How would it be possible for a distributor without enough stamps to buy a large number of cigarettes with the intention of storing some and procuring stamps for them later? And would such an option run afoul of the state of Illinois requirements? You know what I'm saying.
I understand your question. I guess I'll answer it in two parts. First, to the extent that this purchaser, this licensed distributor of cigarettes in the state of Illinois, purchased those cigarettes from a licensed manufacturer or distributor, then, yes, they could go out and purchase as many cigarettes as they wanted to, and simply before they sold them and put them in the stream of commerce, they needed to have the tax stamps affixed to them. But that's not the case here, because here, the moment that they purchased these cigarettes from the ATF undercover warehouse, a wholly illegitimate source, they had bought them from an unlicensed, illegitimate distributor, and therefore they couldn't place the tax stamps on the cigarettes before they placed them into commerce. It was their defense that they did, but when they did so, if they did so, that was not allowed for under the terms of their Illinois cigarette distributor license.
But tell me this, are you aware of any other instances involving a prosecution under this, 2342A, where the defendants were authorized by state law to purchase unstamped cigarettes, as the two defendants were here?
Where the prosecution was based on the
statute under Section 2342A.
Yes, where the licensed, where the defendants were licensed to purchase but were not in compliance with the terms of their license when making those purchases?
I didn't add all that in.
Well, I'm not aware of any other prosecutions where it's relying upon the limited exception where the defendants are licensees but have failed to comply with the requirements of their license.
How does Illinois punish violations of the cigarette licensure requirements and regulations? I mean, are there criminal penalties in the Illinois Code?
For the Illinois state tax, cigarette tax violations, yes. There are criminal penalties. There are also civil penalties and restitution.
So I take it every state has its own internal regulatory framework for taxing the distribution and use of cigarettes. Is that true?
Yes, Your Honor. And that's why what Congress did was created this broad prohibition against the possession or purchase, sale, transportation of untaxed cigarettes. And then there are very few limited exceptions for individuals who's in possession, the untaxed cigarettes are not considered contraband.
You
and
know,
that refers to the state law, because there are separate state cigarette tax laws in each state.
You might not be comfortable answering this question, and if you're not, then you mustn't. I'll surely understand. But, of course, I've been wondering what prompted the sting operation here.
Well, in this instance, there was a complaint by a legitimate distributor.
A competitor.
Yes, who was being undercut by these low, I guess I'll say below market value sales.
So we don't have antitrust problems here, I take it.
Not that I'm aware of.
Let me ask you about the below market sales as far as the judge's forfeiture order. So what is the basis for that forfeiture? How did he come to that conclusion?
Sure. And the basis for the forfeiture was, first, under the case law, because trafficking contraband cigarettes isn't considered an inherently illegal activity, the judge stated that the government could have sought the forfeiture of the wholesale value of all of the purchases that supported the counts of conviction. So essentially forfeited the total amount that they paid when they came to Milwaukee and bought the cigarettes from an illegal source. But instead, we took the conservative approach of looking at the tax stamps that had been purchased by these two entities and took and subtracted that amount. So essentially what you were doing was taking the cost that they saved by buying these cigarettes from an illegal source at a below market value, even assuming that they charged their customers the same price when they resold them, and even assuming that they applied tax stamps to each one, which, again, there was circumstantial evidence that they did not have enough tax stamps to apply those. And that was the basis of the forfeiture.
It's kind of inconsistent with the restitution, though. You know, in the restitution aspect, he got rid of the million or so packs and said, I'm only going to hold you responsible loss amount for, you know, in a very conservative estimate, the $220,000 or so. But then he held the forfeiture for the entire scheme, essentially, right?
Well, it was similar in the sense that with the restitution, he looked at, this is how many packs of cigarettes I can determine that you bought from legal sources and illegal sources, and compared that number to the total amount of tax stamps. And the difference was what was due and owing to the state of Illinois for the tax loss. And then I guess here it's looking more at, instead of the loss to the state of Illinois, it's looking to the extra profit that these individuals obtain by buying them at the lower source, even giving them credit for the taxes they had paid when they technically were not supposed to be putting the tax stamps on these cigarettes in the first place.
Okay. How much does it cost to become registered and licensed to distribute cigarettes?
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor. I'd have to go back and check the record as to what the initial registration fee was to become licensed as a cigarette manufacturer or cigarette distributor.
I'm just wondering if it's a lot, you know.
I'm sorry, I don't want to guess, Your Honor. I don't want to say yes or no because I don't know the specific number.
It's just, you know, curious.
I understand. And then I guess I'll just briefly touch on the void for vagueness argument. Again, this argument was addressed by the district court, but it was again raised inappropriately. But because it's a void for vagueness argument that doesn't challenge the First Amendment, it's looked at it on an as-applied basis. And here, there was substantial evidence that these two defendants were aware of what the requirements with respect to the accounting and payment of the Illinois cigarette taxes were, and it was no surprise to them that they could only buy from licensed manufacturers. They had to file the cigarette tax returns on a monthly basis, and they did so when they were purchasing from legitimate sources, but not when they were purchasing from illegitimate sources, as the ATF undercover warehouse was. See, my time is up.
Thank you, Ms. Wodersky. Ms. Lewis.
The first thing that I'd like to address, Judge Rovner, you talked about how the jury didn't hear any evidence that the defendants intended to sell unstamped cigarettes. There was no evidence of that. There was no evidence that they had some sort of plan to not purchase enough stamps to stamp the cigarettes. The only evidence that was presented was that they purchased unstamped cigarettes and that they purchased fewer tax stamps. But again, as Your Honor stated, you can keep the cigarettes. I don't know what the expiration for a cigarette is, but I do know that it's not 2 weeks. It's not like milk.
Was there any evidence, Ms. Lewis, that they were aware they were purchasing from an unlicensed dealer?
Yes and no, Your Honor. There was some evidence that, and this goes back to the motion to bar issue, which is that Mr. Wamake actually came to us prior to any sort of arrest. We actually took him in and spoke to the government about it, and there was evidence as to what was said at that meeting was disallowed because it would have caused Mr. Seiden to have to testify. But what it comes down to is that he did think that there might be something suspicious, went to the government, and then continued to do it, which makes no sense whatsoever if he was told that he was going to be arrested for doing so. My time is up, but if you have any further questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
All right, apparently not. Thank you, and thanks to all counsel. The case court will proceed to the third. You had reserved a minute for Ms. Lewis, right?
Correct.
There was no reservation for Ms. Lewis.
We only had 15 minutes between the two of us, so right. We each took 7 minutes and then...
Well, all right. Okay. If you, Mr. Levinson, I'll give you a minute if you had anticipated having rebuttal. You may.
The government has continually said that this activity in Wisconsin that they bought from an illegitimate seller, and our argument is that at that point in time, that was not illegal to purchase from that source, and that when they brought it back to Illinois, that's when any potential violations of running afoul of payment or recording or reporting would have taken place, all within the state of Illinois, all subject to regulation, and that's why we suggest that it is barred by the 10th Amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Robinson. Again, thanks to all counsel. It is taken under